Welcome to Holden Village, and today in the Creekside Room, our speaker is Jackie Brolsma. Her topic, the drug addiction and recovery. So let's listen in on Jackie Brolsma.
My name is Jackie Brolsma, and I've worked in alcohol and drug treatment and research for almost embarrassingly 20 years now in a variety of settings. Rural Midwest, and also in a hospital-based inpatient program, as well as on Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. I currently live and work in Seattle. I'm a mental health nurse practitioner by background, and I work at a downtown drug clinic serving primarily heroin addicted people who also, as you well know, abuse other substances, primarily alcohol and cocaine. We also do ongoing research at my clinic, and for those of you who might be interested, we just completed a large project on acupuncture and addiction. So that's a little bit about me. What I'd like to do in today's session is provide a basic overview of addiction. I'd like to cover sort of four areas if we can. I want to make some opening comments about the overuse of the concept of addiction. Somebody here in the village, we were talking and said, well, doesn't everybody have an addiction? And I think with some of the information out there that we get, people are asking that question. I want to talk some about the current thinking about the etiology or the causes of addiction or how people come to have addiction and some of the recent thinking about that. And I think it's important to talk about that first before I describe the elements and components of addiction, just because a lot of times how we think about how somebody came to be addicted is also what dictates how we want to approach it, or especially how we want to treat it, depending on what we think is maybe causing it for this particular person. So then I'll talk about the components of addiction and then spend some time on treatment and recovery, and maybe if there's time, some of the issues going on in the addiction field right now. I invite your comments from experience, wisdom, or whatever, and I'm not going to be handing out any tests, so you can be fearless with your comments. So, some have referred to this country's current passion with addictions as an addiction splurge. And I think both professionals and lay people have disagreements about what addiction is. And I think sometimes the addiction field has looked like it's going through a bit of an identity crisis because of this idea of trying to define it and get a handle on it. The broadening of the meaning of addiction into the areas of shopping and sex and sometimes exercise and television watching has just, you know, really exploded and has come under some criticism for perhaps extending the metaphor of addiction too far. And I think there's some reasons for why that's happened and also some things to maybe gain from it. But the notion that everybody has an addiction is widely accepted with the newspaper articles and the media and people telling their stories and the self-help groups and new ones kind of touting the discovery of a new addiction now. And so it's no surprise that those who deny having an addiction are sometimes viewed as naive, lacking information, or certainly in denial of their addiction is often what happens. And just to give you a variety of sort of the ideas about addiction and kind of what's being written about it, there are many people who maintain a very narrow sense of addiction, that it's purely a physiological, the body's dependence on a substance, in which dependence has maybe gotten out of control and is affecting the daily functioning of an addict in serious ways. And then we might go as far as Gerald May, who is a very popular writer, a psychiatrist, and I believe also a theologian. He wrote a very well-read book called Addiction and Grace. I think there's copies of it in the bookstore. Has some wonderful information about the spiritual dimensions, but he defines addiction as any compulsive, habitual behavior that limits the freedom of human desire. Well, that's, you know, pretty broad. And I think that, in my mind, this over-labeling reflects social constructions really more than scientific determinations. I think the leap from compulsive behaviors or obsessions to addiction to disease is hazardous and usually not well conceptualized. I worry about the tendency to reduce complex problems to syndromes or diseases or addictions. And I think what happens is it detracts needed attention from societal and political factors that really shape unhealthy behavior, much like what Tony Evans is talking about this week and also Paul Menzel. And then besides those two kind of examples I gave you, many people have read an author by the name of Ann Wilson Shafe, who goes as far to title her book, When Society Becomes an Addict. She takes a systemic view of addiction and says that any substance or process that has taken over our lives and over which we are powerless begins to have control over us. And she's taken it to apply it to societal and political forces, such as militarism. And so, besides the social implications, I think, of overusing that term of addiction, I mean, if everyone fits this label, maybe we're really just describing a human condition. And I think what's happened is that we've gotten a great deal of compassion for understanding addiction when we start to apply the model or the paradigm to some of the parts in our life. And I think when we can make some comparison and look at perhaps our need to get a cup of coffee in the morning really being no less addicted than somebody who isn't at ease unless they get a heroin fix, I think the model of addiction really helps us in many ways to understand the power of this thing over people. But on the other hand, I think we have to be careful because besides the social implications, the numbers really just don't add up. We know that there's probably about 13 million alcohol-dependent people in the country, about 1 million cocaine-dependent, about 500,000 heroin or opiate-dependent people, and about 50 million nicotine-dependent. And if you maybe add compulsive gambling, which is estimated around 1 million, and even if you were to add marijuana-dependent or any of the new disorders, sexual addiction, the numbers just don't approach the 250,000 or 250 million that we have in this country. So I think we have to be careful about the use of that. Another area I want to talk about before we sort of move into looking at some of the etiology, and please feel free to offer your comments here. One of the byproducts, I think, of the search for addictive behaviors is the emphasis on biological factors, such as genetic predisposition, biochemical markers, and the high-risk physiological characteristics seen in children of alcoholics. This is an area we probably all have some interest in, perhaps from our own family histories. Most widely cited evidence for the biological component of addiction is the finding that alcoholism runs in families. The research strongly suggests that children of addicted people are more likely to become addicted to drugs or alcohol themselves. Alcohol is much more clear than with drugs, but these findings are very well supported by twin studies, adoption studies, and half-sibling studies and animal studies. So it's strongly suggesting a genetic factor. I always like to say, though, that, you know, speaking French runs in French-speaking families, but that doesn't make it genetic. So we have to be really careful. There's certainly some genetic component operating here. And furthermore, that biological predisposition may be independent of parenting and environmental factors. But a possible and common misinterpretation of these findings can lead us to the belief that, you know, all alcoholics are equally predisposed to alcoholism and that this predisposition is overwhelming. There is evidence that male children of alcoholic parents are more likely to develop alcoholism than sons of biological non-alcoholic parents. 20 to 25% of sons of alcoholics become alcohol dependent. But because even fewer females with familial alcoholism, alcoholism in their family, become alcoholic, it's apparent that most individuals in alcoholic families do not become alcoholic. A whole other issue would look at sort of how you see depression more in the women coming from alcoholic families. But in contrast, there are many people without familial alcoholism who also become alcoholic. So I think there's certainly some strong research that, you know, draws our attention in this area of genetics that we have to pay attention to. But we have to be careful. And I really believe that we should actually be studying more the people who don't become, that we have a lot to learn from that as opposed to focusing merely on the pathology. And our country sort of has an obsession with that. And we begin to think that everybody who grew up in an alcoholic family is going to turn out this exact way, and they're all going to have these certain characteristics. And I think we have to sort of be careful about the labeling and so forth that we do. So, any comments to anything so far? Does it ring with your own experience in terms of being out there and hearing about addiction? Well, if something comes to mind, feel free to interrupt me. Let's take some time and look at some of the theories or the causes of addiction. And again, I say it's important to sort of sort this out, because how we think about maybe how somebody got addicted is going to dictate a lot about what we think we ought to do about it. So that's why I want to take some time with this. We can really kind of put some of these thoughts in three categories. The first one being where we would focus on the drug, and we'd say that people become alcoholic because of the addictive properties in alcohol, or they become heroin addicts because of how addictive heroin is. And we would say that it's the properties in the drug that basically cause people to become addicted. Certainly a component, certainly something we have to pay attention to. Or it's the disinhibition effects of the substance creating impaired judgment that makes people become addicts. So there's that sort of thread of looking at really the substance itself. Then we can shift and say, no, it's within the individual that causes people to become addicted. And we might say it's within their psychological makeup. For many years, we thought that there was a search on much, a lot of money was spent on trying to find this addictive personality. And sorry to say, it doesn't exist. Despite lots of money spent on trying to define that. And I think it's better to view it as really an equal opportunity condition. And I think there was one researcher that, I lost my comment now, but talked about the research is going to show that they're going to that alcoholics are going to show that they have more or less of this particular trait. So there really is a myth around that notion of there being an equal, or that there being an addictive personality. The National Institute of Drug Abuse has really said that anybody with a healthy, functioning nervous system is vulnerable to addiction. So we might also say they have a self-destructive streak in them, or they're morally weak. And for years, that's basically how the church approached it. We said that it was just people were perhaps lacking in faith or whatever, and many times unenlightened clergy would say, well, just go to church more or pray more and you'll be able to kind of stop this addiction. And we know that it's much more complicated than that. Or we might say that they're psychically deprived, or they're powerless, or they're thrill seekers. All pictures of addiction certainly enter in some way. Or we might say it's a biological thing. It's purely their genetic makeup that makes them alcoholic, or it's some neurochemical imbalance in them. We know that that's a factor, like I said. Or we can shift and focus more on the environment of the person who develops addiction. And we might say it's the people they hung out with. You know, if they would never have associated with this particular crowd, they would have never become addicted. Or they had such strong loyalties that the peer pressure caused them to become addicted. or that they had a certain expectation about a drug that perhaps caused them to become addicted. And I think sometimes a way to think about this environmental sort of approach is you can probably say that there are many Vietnam vets, had they never ever gone to Vietnam, been exposed to opiates over there, may not, you know, under given different life circumstances, may not have ever become opiate dependent, but the circumstances, you know, were such that happened. Well, I think you know that it's much more complex than that, and so actually theories today really look much more at what I put up there, a biopsychosocial model, that really all of those things come into play, that there might be the genetic predisposition there, but say perhaps the person has a certain psychological or emotional makeup, that the addiction may never ever develop in them because perhaps they never had a certain stressful event in their life, or they never had a particular situation come up. And so it's much more complex when we look at how addiction comes. It really has to take in mind the biological, the psychological, and certainly the social or the environment of the person. So what is addiction? I don't want to make it very complicated. Everybody see that okay? I think most people would agree that the elements of addiction, be that alcohol or drugs, is certainly going to include these things. And the first one is the compulsion or the craving to use. And this is merely the irresistible urge to act or to use or take the substance. It's not a matter of I don't need it, it's I got to have it sort of thing. And really, this compulsion, not only the mental obsession with the substance, the craving really has two components to it. There's certainly the biological, and this is really the body changes that occur with continued use, the develop of tolerance, where the brain cells change in structure over time to adapt to the regular induction of the substance, so that really when the substance isn't available, the cells are essentially crying out for it. It's kind of a simple explanation. But it's very comparable to the little bit of anxiety and jitteriness you experience in the morning if you're a regular caffeine drinker. And that's a very mild form of biological cravings or the withdrawal. And it's that trigger often then for wanting to use more. And it would be very simple if the biological craving was really all there was to addiction, because you get rid of that and it's fine. There's no problem. And that really goes away, depending on the substance, in a matter of a few days, the biological. But there's this other component, which is more of an emotional process, which are the conditioned cues that have to do with the triggers, really, to use. And these might be internal or external. They might be certain mood states, like I drink only when I'm happy, or I drink only when I'm sad. And there's a response to a certain particular internal state of being where the person wants to use. Or it might be an external situation, like perhaps there's an association with a particular location of drinking, or it's associated with perhaps watching football, or a certain tavern, or drug use is associated with a certain group of people, or in a certain location. So it can be internal or external, and by far, those are the more powerful elements of this compulsion than really just the biological to deal with. And I think when we talk about recovery, it's important to remember that component of craving, because that becomes a very important task in terms of recovering from an addiction. The loss of control over use. Now a lot of people might say, well, you know, I never lose control over my drinking, but it's not that it has to happen every time. It can be episodic, and that's really essentially using more than intended. In other words, it's the loss of control. It's maybe I'm going to have two or three drinks, and I end up having 5, 10, you know, or whatever. A very simple element of addiction, not simple in terms of dealing with, but explaining it is. And then another element, and this is probably what makes people around the person with addiction be baffled, is that the continued use, despite adverse consequences, seeing the harm that comes to a person's life with the addiction is baffling to all of us. You know, that people will give up jobs, money, commit crimes, marriages, families break up, spiritual bankruptcy, whatever, but the use still continues. And drugs become primary reinforcers. They are a very quick reward for whatever sort of ails us. And like I said, this is where the addiction really takes on a life of its own. This reward mechanism is very, very strong, more powerful than what family or jobs or friends or whatever can sometimes be. The salience of use, I think, is pretty explainable. That is just the power that addiction has over people, and the importance then of obtaining the substance has. I would add another one, and that's relapse. The high probability of relapse in addiction and the occurrence of that. People don't instantly overcome addiction. It's very much a process and not an event. And I think sometimes we don't talk about that enough in the addiction field. Comments, questions, anything? I want to just show you sort of the official diagnostic criteria that people use when they're diagnosing addiction. And most of these are just elaboration of the points that I already made. Substance often taken in larger amounts over a longer period than the person intended. That's the loss of control. Persistent desire or one or more unsuccessful efforts to cut down or control the substance. This is where the person may try repeatedly to try and quit and not be able to do that. A great deal of time spent, the obsession in trying to procure, thinking about it a lot when you maybe want to be thinking about something else. Frequent intoxication or withdrawal symptoms when expected to fulfill major role obligations at work, school, home, when substance use is physically hazardous even. Important social, occupational, or recreational activities might be given up or reduced because of the substance use. You can see the progression over time. Continued use despite the knowledge of having a persistent or reoccurring social or whatever problem that gets exacerbated by the use of the substance. That's the continued use despite harmful consequences. And then just a couple more. The tolerance that I mentioned, the need to increase the amount in order to get the desired effect. What used to be able to satisfy a person requires more and more, and that's because of the body's need for that. The withdrawal symptoms, not always present in addiction, but some people generally experience them. And the substance often taken to relieve or avoid those particular symptoms. So. Okay. Any comments or things people want to add or highlight or disagree with before we talk about treatment?
One of the things you did mention nicotine, Jack. I think one of the things is probably one of the most addicting substances in those problems.
Definitely.
And the way we're dealing with nicotine addiction, the skin patches, the biological interference, just aren't working.
Right.
Because it's the same stuff, the same condition,
yeah.
The same condition things that one has a cigarette or a meal. We're always dealing with that right now, and that's why they're pushing the patches and stuff, because there's a lot of money to be made, but they don't work.
And that's really addressing just the
sure.
physiological, like
yeah.
I mentioned.
We all know they don't work. cigarette patches and he's going to work.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about nicotine addiction, too, is that 95% of the people who stop smoking really do it without any kind of formal intervention. And we really have a lot to learn from those people about how they do it. And there are also many people who sort of, they're either called natural recovery or spontaneous remissions, who suddenly stop using a substance and sort of incorporate those elements of recovery that I'm going to talk about without any kind of formal intervention. But nicotine is certainly one of our most serious addictions. And I think Paul is going to even, aren't you talking about nicotine addiction and attacking that whole issue in one of your sessions?
Partly.
So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So when we talk about recovery, we're not just talking about treatment, just as when we speak of justice for the poor, we're not just talking about welfare programs. Recovering from an addiction is a process and not a one-time event. And like I said, there are many people who do recover without any kind of formal intervention. But some of the essential tasks of recovery really include some of these things that I'm going to mention. And I think it's important to also say that recovery is very much viewed as a journey, like I said, a process, and that there are many pathways to get there. I think we're only beginning to learn. that there's a variety of ways, and that we can't just kind of use a cookie cutter approach to treatment. And that's essentially what, rightfully so, the addiction field has been criticized for and are beginning to take a look at and in some exciting ways. First of all, dealing with those cravings that I mentioned is a very important task and challenge, both the biological and the social. It requires really almost inventorying your life situation and beginning to do some actual behavioral planning around those situations and beginning to know very much about your own addiction and how, what particular situations are triggers and cues. And I think the support groups do an excellent job of helping people to do that along with treatment. But learning from other people about how to, you know, do things differently than use the substance. And we do know that the best treatment predictor of outcome is really length of time in treatment. That if we can get people to stay longer in treatment, they do better. And I don't mean necessarily in the hospital, but engaged in sort of ongoing sort of recovery. And I think the reason for that is that they begin to learn more and more about those trigger situations that we talked about. That when I'm angry, I really want to use. Or, you know, gosh, when I watch football, all I can think about is having a beer. And really beginning to learn different ways of doing that. So dealing with the craving certainly is one of those. The other one is the re-socialization that has to take place. Drug use happens in social situations, or at least obtaining it does. Often all of the networks for people who struggle with addiction are also users, both legally, alcohol, as well as the illegal substances. And very often, especially in the work that I am involved in, partners are also. And this is especially true for women. They tend to be, women who come in for addiction treatment are often more connected or partnered up with people who also have an addiction. And very often the identity comes from that social group. And so the need to find non-drug using people and almost redefine your social network is a tremendous challenge for people with addiction. Some of you who might be former smokers know that that was probably hard even in early recovery. And I think, again, this is where a lot of the support groups provide that for people, beginning to find a whole new social network. And I am going to talk a little more about 12-step groups later in the week. Besides dealing with the drug cravings and the resocialization, another important task is dealing with the problems of retarded maturation. And essentially when people begin to use substances, the emotional development essentially freezes. And in the addicted population that I work, most of them began using alcohol and drugs and perhaps even had a heroin addict in their teens. And you know that there's still a lot of emotion, even into our 20s and so forth. And essentially, that gets frozen. And so the natural emotional maturation process is really sort of paralyzed. And so it's proportional to age, of course. But drug use really becomes the substitute coping mechanism that we generally learn sort of through those stages in life. And so it requires really absolutely sometimes new, totally new coping skills for people, which is not any small task. And so the process of recovery is no sort of straight diagonal line. It's much more like this and, you know, an up and down kind of effect. And the challenge of recovery may often mean saying yes as well as saying no. Creative endeavors, improving social skills, and really learning to live a more balanced and healthy lifestyle are all parts of that. Anything else people want to add about the tasks of recovery or the challenges? I think there's many more, but...
Define recovery. You never recovered, are you?
Well, that's sort of a controversy. I think people who have often struggled with addiction, many of them prefer to sort of keep that notion that I'm always on this path and I'm always recovering and there's always more to learn and to grow. In the addiction field, because it's such a relapsing condition, words like cure are generally not used. But there are portions of the addicted population who are very fine calling themselves, you know, recovered and feel that the addiction is behind them and they've moved on. So it's very much an individual thing, I would say. Is that kind of what you meant? Yeah.
When people, it's kind of popular to use the dry drunk surgeon, is that usually then applied to people who maybe haven't worked on some of these other tasks?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way. It's really a term that comes out of AA, but in many ways it's addressing that biological component only that I mentioned before. And then I think it's sometimes used in recovering circles also to talk about people who are not sort of continuing that process of self-examination, that they're really just not using, but they have all these other kind of old behaviors activated and still going on. Yeah.
The difficulty of moving from being addicted to non-addicted seems to, you know, just from the lay view, seems to be really dependent in part upon the drug itself. Can you talk about that? We seem to be moving to an opiate culture, for instance, more so than... And I'm just curious of how strong those addictions are and how people are... I think many of us know many people, for instance, who quit smoking in the past 10 years. And they've been quite able to do that. But I have kind of a sense that the opiates is much more difficult to do. Can you kind of give us a sense for...
Well, I would never want to sort of define anybody's level of difficulty because of all of those factors that I mentioned. I mean, the biology may be particularly strong for a certain person. I mean, we know sort of medically the withdrawals... detoxification time required for cocaine is very short, heroin is very short, alcohol is very short, that the actual withdrawal physiologically is a very, very short time. Methadone is a longer acting, I think it's the shorter acting drugs are always going to have a shorter detoxing kind of time. And it's important to remember that probably the effect of the drug going in is going to be the opposite going out. It's kind of that simple. A stimulant is going to cause the opposite effect when it leaves your body. There's a crashing that you know when people come up with cocaine. people coming off of sedatives like opiates and alcohol are going to get anxious. Their nervous system is going to be agitated, and they're going to be kind of revved up. Same with nicotine. Caffeine. But I think when you look at all of the other social and cultural elements of addiction for people, having worked in a variety of settings, I certainly know that narcotic addiction is a very powerful addiction to recover from. And that has to do with not only the physiological component that we're getting to get some clues about, in the sense of learning more about people's endorphins, and that the continued repetitive use of opiates seems to suppress that, and that the physiological changes with continued opiate use makes it extremely difficult physiologically to recover, which is why methadone is certainly a very viable step towards perhaps abstaining. Although there's some evidence that opiate addicts definitely, there's not some evidence, there's a lot of evidence that they do better on methadone than they do off. I don't know if I'm answering your question really, but I think that it's more a matter of the culture for the person, the network they come from, the socioeconomic conditions, all of those things I think dictate the challenge of recovery for people. But I can talk a little bit about drug trends, and there's definitely, I know Seattle, King County, because that's kind of where I'm from, and there's certainly increased opiate. Especially the media's given a lot of attention to Kurt Cobain's death, but certainly opiate use has been up. And it has to do with cost of, illegal substances, all of those things enter in.
I wanted to ask about methadone. When they're taken off of narcotics and put it on methadone, is that habitual too?
It is addicting, definitely.
That's mm-hmm. what I've heard. And then you start out with one pot into the next pot, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah, I'll tell my own story here. I used to be a very strong opponent of methadone. I worked in an abstinence-based program, and saw people coming off of methadone and saw the difficulty. But at the same time, I also knew that heroin addicts were not succeeding at all in the abstinence-based programs, that they were using within days, really, of coming out of some of these programs. And that I have seen now working in methadone, the value in terms of reduction of HIV risk because of continued injection drug use, and that because there is such, the reduction in crime, we see 60% reduction in crime within a matter of a few weeks of people getting on methadone.
Well, some foreign countries give, I've seen it in Amsterdam, I've seen it.
Right.
Yeah, in mm-hmm. Switzerland, mm-hmm. those countries, they have big, big long trailers in there and just handing it out to people like candy or something.
Right.
Just to keep.
And, it's important. There are certainly definitely people who get on methadone who don't continue to abstain from using heroin or maybe other substances, but it's one of the most well-monitored and regulated programs, really, really around. So,
how much of problems do they come when they're trying to get off of methadone? Is it much easier?
It's like I tell my clients, many of them are hesitant to get on it despite the, incredible heroin addicts. They also know that methadone is really, one of the best ways to get off. But you have to remember that methadone is a longer acting narcotic. So it's not necessarily that it's worse, it's that it's longer. And so it requires, the lifestyle changes required for a narcotic addict to recover are enormous. And so it takes a long time to be on it, to make those changes and then to slowly, very slowly, detox. But people who are on methadone are not euphoric. When they're on methadone, they're at their tolerant dose of a narcotic. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're high mm-hmm. or anything from methadone. So, okay. Any other comments or questions? I want to talk a little bit about relapse, because it is such a common phenomenon. This is really work that comes out of the University of Washington. Marlatt and and Gordon. And it's really a model that's used in a variety of behavioral changes. And I think it's important to remember that in addiction, we're not talking about relapse being due to weak will or poor morals or etc. It's really the process of dealing and struggling with new behaviors. But I just want to walk you through this and give you an example about the challenge of recovery. And we can begin over here on this side with the addict being put in sort of a high-risk situation. Is that like not very... Is it getting better?
Yeah.
Okay. And this situation might be perhaps a negative emotional state, or maybe something's gone wrong, or angry, or there's something terribly sad happened, or whatever. It might be an interpersonal conflict that happens, or it might be one of those triggers that I mentioned before, where they're being around a previous drug situation. Maybe it's experiencing pain, if that was perhaps a relapse cue for people, or insomnia or whatever. But let's just say that in their recovery, they've really learned some new coping responses. They've learned different ways to deal with that. If it's calling a non-using friend, going out for a run, going and getting a massage, going to a movie, doing whatever. They've learned talking it through with somebody. They've learned a new coping response, and they use that. And the result of that is increased, self-esteem, feeling better about themselves. They end up feeling really empowered, and their own self-efficacy is increased. And that really moves to push them towards reducing the tendency to relapse. It's sort of like a savings account, It's like, that's money in the bank for future, because high-risk situations are always going to happen for people who recover from an addiction. There's just no escaping them. But let's look the other way. Let's say they don't have those. Let's say they've really just maybe up and quit, and that's all they've done. And suddenly they're encountering this other situation, and they've done really nothing more than stop taking in the substance. And suddenly they find themselves with no way to handle this particular situation. That's not exactly, a building of one's sense of self-worth or any kind of empowerment. They actually may feel so powerless. And very quickly they begin to recall the positive effects of drug use, that sort of notion of euphoric recall. Suddenly all they can remember is how great it felt, to have that glass of wine, or how great it felt, to, light up a cigarette, or go fix, or whatever. And so they end up slipping, and there's a distinction between slip and a full-blown relapse. Because at that point, they end up feeling that their abstinence has been violated. There's a tremendous sense of guilt, remorse, they feel awful about themselves. And if no intervention really takes place, it is going to progress into relapse and continued use. But I think we're learning much, much more about this relapse process and being able to help people in intervening more like in this area. Maybe even before the slip happens, and to be realistic about what's possible, so that the person doesn't have to progress really into full-blown relapse. Any comments on that? I think you can see that it works for any kind of behavioral change that you want to make. This has especially been researched in the area of cigarette. As long as we've still got some time, I want to talk a little bit about the addiction treatment in terms of, I think we've come a long way in helping people struggle with addictions. I think, gone are the days of throwing people in jail or locking them up in institutions and not knowing what to do with them. And I think many, many lives have been saved because treatment has moved into the whole area of healthcare and behavioral treatment and so forth. But we still have a long way to go. There are lots of criticisms one can make of the addiction field and shortcomings. We're still not able to match, I don't think, the right kind of approach with the person. I think we're still, like I said, doing kind of a cookie-cutter approach and sort of slapping the same kind of model on everybody and kind of putting everybody through this sort of maybe standard 21-day or and it, you know, everybody goes to the same group and everybody goes to the same session and everybody has to go to AA or NA or whatever, and we're sort of, we've not given much attention to really the individual needs of people. And despite the success rates that dip really below 50% in alcohol treatment programs, people have continued to provide this kind of same model. But I think there's hope with the ongoing research that's happening in terms of evaluating the effectiveness of a lot of these programs. And I think one of the more exciting areas is work that comes out of Stanford, looking at the whole notion of motivation and the stages of change. I think this probably relates a lot to what Tony Evans is talking this week also, that we're beginning to learn that there are really stages in the process of making a change, and that basically it's a wheel that we may go around a bit before we actually sustain this change. And I think we used to think that if a client or a patient agreed with a therapist, they were well motivated. If they disagreed, they were definitely in denial and probably weren't motivated. And I think our thinking has come a little bit further, where we're really redefining motivation because of these people's work, and that it's not some personality trait or something within the person, but rather it's the probability that a person will enter into, continue, and adhere to a specific change strategy. And that there's different things we do depending on where that person is in the stage process of making a change. And I think a good example of that is perhaps maybe doing an intervention out of the Johnson Institute model of intervention that you might have heard about, where people confront the addict. And you know many cases where, you know, people up and it divided families and, you know, people were angry. And I think sometimes addiction intervention has taken place without really paying attention to perhaps where the person was in this process of thinking about having a problem. And I'll just sort of walk you through this, and maybe you could comment on it. But before you even get into this wheel, there's this pre-contemplation stage where basically there's lack of recognition of even having a problem. And they're not even yet considering the possibility of change. And so you can imagine at this point, if somebody who's a smoker and you're suddenly telling them they're going to have to quit entirely, and up until that point they've not even thought they had a problem, it's probably more likely at this stage that they're going to be more surprised actually than perhaps defensive, because at this point they haven't even really thought there's really anything wrong. But let's say they move, maybe they get some information or something happens at that point, and they move into the contemplation where there's this ambivalence and there's this seesawing that goes on between the reasons to change versus the reasons to stay the same. And the person is kind of going back and forth here, kind of like, well, maybe I got a problem, but, you know, maybe I don't. And there's this movement towards a recognition of a problem. And we're going to do certain interventions at that level that we might not do back maybe at pre-contemplation. And then if they do sort of move into this determination where this is where I got to do something, you know, there is something wrong. And this is where you're going to really sort of help the person with a strategy or a change that they can succeed at, something that they can really feel good that they've done. And maybe that means just cutting down to maybe 10 cigarettes a day versus quitting completely. Or it's something that they can really live and identify with. And then they make that action. This is where the really completion of the task to solve the problem. And then the maintenance is where they really maintain that change. As you know, it's one set of behaviors to lose weight, it's another just to maintain that weight loss. And so the maintenance is a whole other process in the recovery of making a change. And then, of course, you know, relapse. And like I said, you know, people can continue to go around this circle. We just got funding to do a project in Seattle working with street cocaine addicts, really incorporating this stage of change that they're, you know, it's taking time to assess where the particular person is at in thinking about their life problem, and that you're going to use different strategies based on where they are in the whole process of thinking about making a change. So I think this offers some hope for getting better at treatment and helping people with addictions. And I think there's really an effort to move from the realm of experience and faith, really, into more empiricism and really a more natural development of science when we're beginning to look at addiction. So, any comments or additions?
Question.
Yeah. What about age? Do you see very many adolescents, junior high, middle school kids who actually get in that wheel? Are they usually in a pre-contemplative state of not even recognizing that they have a problem?
No,
adolescents are certainly, that's a whole other topic. I don't work in adolescent treatment because people in my program have to be 18 or older. I mean, that's a federal law in terms of getting on methadone, of course. But just recently, our executive director was at a meeting with the Seattle School District where they were beginning. They do the same. There's a standardized survey that they do every year, actually nationally, that they've been doing for a number of years now on drug use in the schools. And they're now, they were telling him, even beginning to think about methadone treatment for at teenagers, because they were beginning to get reports of much more increased opiate use in teens. But certainly addiction happens in adolescence, but we have to be very careful because experimental use takes place in that stage. And experimentation is not necessarily a negative thing. In fact, we know even that if you were to divide up experimenting adolescents with those who, you know, never ever do anything and those who maybe recreational regular use, that actually you see better psychological profiles in the experimenters than you do in either of the other categories. So that's another controversy, addiction treatment for adolescents as well. But I think there's a real movement to get much more sophisticated about making sure that people are indeed are addicted and they're in the right place, and that's really the problem. So, that's the question.
I'm a science teacher in junior high who has been requested for the last, say, 4 years to teach, including drug and alcohol addiction. And one of the, without any information really, I don't have a health endorsement. Told that I need to teach it. So we've been getting a lot of in-service from this good district. But what I was hearing, what I've heard very clearly, and I'll check this out with you, you know, adolescents supposedly become addicted. The rate of addiction is much, much higher than it is with adults. If they choose to use, they can get addicted twice as easily, even more than that. That's what I heard. The other one is that once addicted, that the length of time in the addiction to whether it's cirrhosis of the liver or whatever, it takes a much, much shorter time than to go the scope of the use. Mm-hmm. So they're easier in, and they go, and we're talking 18 years, there's some 18 years for the end results of alcohol addiction versus 18 months for the end results of alcohol addiction with kids. Mm-hmm. Now, is that valid?
Well, I could argue with very specific, minute things about what you said, but I think generally, I think that's true. I mean,
that's scary. That's what I can say to kids. Mm-hmm. Well, this is what the dad says, mm-hmm. you know, and that it's a much, much bigger thing to risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, certainly nicotine and alcohol are the gateway drugs, and you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about this so-called drug war that we've had going on in our country. Another session, I guess tomorrow, and that we've really kind of had our priorities in the wrong place, and prevention and what we're modeling in terms of youth is really where more of our efforts need to go. So it's good to hear that you're doing some of that.
From the outside looking into this problem, the situation you're in to me looks very difficult to deal with. Give us some insight as to how you deal with these people. I mean, how do you position yourself in dealing with the problems these people bring to you? Or how do you approach it? As a scientist, or as a human person, or a little both, or what?
I'd say both, yeah. I'm a clinician. I sort of stumbled into the field of addiction, starting on an Indian reservation in northern Minnesota. Have no personal family history of addiction, but really kind of got addicted to the field once I was in. And now it's sort of like all I know. But and I guess some of it was just the draw for recovering people. I think if you've ever had the opportunity to know them and have them share their story, it's a very powerful experience and witness. And I've worked in a variety of settings, and like I said, I was in some of the glitzier treatment programs and found it, you know, very stimulating. And after a lot of travel and actually some pretty extended time here at Holden, I made a decision I really wanted to work with the more disenfranchised population. And certainly heroin addiction in our country today is that. We can't get more ostracized than being a heroin addict in terms of the HIV risk and just sort of the leprosy approach to them. So, you know, I don't want to say it's all altruistic for me. It's an exciting field to work in. I think some of the neurochemistry research that's coming out is very exciting. But I guess I think I've learned a lot from addicted people. The survival, they're survivors, and also the diversity of the population I see. You know, I'm fortunate to see people who are coming off the streets who've had, you know, $300-$400 a day habits, to people who are very stable, have been perhaps in methadone treatment a long time, having successful jobs. You would not be able to tell who they are. Former baseball players to former, you know, professional musicians. And I like being able to see the spectrum. I like being able to see people, you know, at that really down and out state to all the way on the other end. And certainly the spiritual dimension is there, whether it's ever sort of like talked about. It certainly taught me a lot about faith and hope and, you know, all of those things. So, but it's also a very exciting field to work in terms of research as well. So,
I think what he was approaching was how you approach it.
Personally, you mean?
Personally. When you have an addict come in, just how do you approach it?
Well, my role in the setting I'm in now is I make the determination whether or not they're qualified to start up methadone. And there's very specific criteria for that. I mean, people have to come in opiate withdrawal in order to be on methadone. We don't want to put anybody who's not an opiate-addicted person on methadone. I mean, it's an addicting drug. So the criteria for that are very strict. And so I have to make that determination. And so the people come, you know, already wanting to get into treatment by the time
where
I see them.
Where do they come from? Does the judge say you go?
No, these are...
voluntarily come?
Some people are on probation, certainly for crimes, but no, I think...
If I were to go, I wouldn't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
If
well,
I wanted
the word
to go
is out.
For treatment, where would I go?
You know, the heroin community is a pretty well-knit, you know, group. And,
for sales and consumption.
Unfortunately, the waiting period is like 6 weeks. I mean, we don't have enough slots to treat people who are addicted to opiates. At least, you know, not with methadone. We could use many more, but it's well controlled and regulated by the government. You know, I also do HIV testing, and because I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, I also do psychiatric evaluation on people who are not only addicted but also have psychiatric conditions, and prescribe medications and treat them for that. I don't know, Ruth, how do I personally deal with it? Certainly it's taken some time to, you know, after almost 20 years, to sort of learn how to kind of deal with that, you know, piece of your life. I think I'm fortunate to work in a very well-run agency where there's a very good work ethic, and there's an understanding that this is hard work, and, you know, what you do away from here is very important, and, you know, get out of here if your work is done. And I think it promotes a real, you know, healthy approach to working, you know, with these people. I think keeping that part of your life, you know, just in healthy perspective has been real important. Outside interests. But I think once one sees the potential and the opportunity for recovery, it fuels you, you know, for the next person. And there's tremendous joy in seeing people, you know, change their lives in ways that I wonder many days if I could ever do. So, it's, you know, that gives you fuel for the next person. And certainly, in our population, we see a lot of sociopathic and personality disorders that are extremely difficult.